History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to, as long as people like you and I are willing to take a little time to ask a few questions, and most importantly, to listen to what some of our more experienced Americans have to say. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm sure that'll be the case again today in Madera, California, with 94-year-old Kenneth Orville Leach. His friends call him K.O. 5 years ago, they called him Madera County's Senior Farmer of the Year because he was still farming and obviously setting a powerful example. But we're going to go back a few decades earlier. You were born in January 1926, almost 95 years ago, and you were the oldest of four kids?
Yes, there were three boys and one girl, four children.
And where'd you grow up?
Baker, Oklahoma.
Where's that?
It's about 15 miles northeast of Shawnee, Oklahoma. I was born in the hospital at Shawnee, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
It was 14 miles southwest of Maker. Maker's on the railroad that goes through Oklahoma.
Did you grow up on a farm?
Yes.
What all did you guys farm?
My dad farmed cotton, corn. He had milk cows, mules, and wagons. I'm the last of my family that rode on a wagon from home to Maker with a load of cotton.
So when we see the University of Oklahoma play a football game and they have the Sooner Schooner, that covered wagon, rolling out before the game, you actually rode in one of those, a real one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, several times. I went to the state fair in Oklahoma City. The Indians put on a show. There were Indians in Oklahoma, Seminole, you know, Seminole, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Oil. Jackson took the Indians and put them all in Oklahoma because Jackson and his commander wanted to get the Indian land. That's why Jackson did it.
Andrew Jackson, the president.
Andrew Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
He became president later,
right.
But he was in the army then. But he didn't know he put them on the biggest oil place in the United States. But anyway, my dad liked state fairs. He'd take us. I went to California state fairs a couple of times. Maker, I went to Oklahoma City. Indians put it, they had a wagon, mules, and they set the wagon on fire and run through the round with the wagon on fire till it got put out.
They would do a reenactment like that?
Well, no, I didn't see anybody get hurt, but you never seen anything like a bunch of Indians either. I was 7 years old when my mother sent me to school. She didn't want me to go by myself. So my cohort, Gerald, 15 months later than me, and he was eligible to go to school. And so we had to walk to school, no buses. And we had to go across a neighbor's field, 80 acres of oak trees. Across this field, we could go without going the road, make it twice place to walk. It'd take longer.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd cut across. But he had a bull and cattle in that 80 acres, and that bull would chase us. But we'd get in these trees, and the bull would stand there and paw the ground and butt the tree and try to get us down. I never thought about it then, but I don't know what my mother was thinking. You know, if that had been a day like this, they wouldn't have let you leave the house, you know.
I'm just wondering if that teacher bought your excuse when you say I'm late because a bull put me up in a tree. I don't know if they would fall for that.
Well, usually the bull didn't stay too long. If the cattle moved off, the cows moved off, he'd go with them, and we could get down. But in those days, Oklahoma was Oklahoma. I mean.
And was that a one-room schoolhouse?
No, it had two rooms.
Uh-huh. A big school.
Well, teacher was a man, and his sister was a teacher. She had the lower grades, 1, 2, 3, or 1 and 2, and then he had 3 and 4. They taught the school, and just in their family, they lived in Meeker. They'd drive out, teach school. They were good teachers. They were really good.
As the oldest child, I imagine you had the toughest chores around the farm.
Yes, in this forest of trees, my dad ran the cattle in there. When he milked them, he turned them out there. They had a mile to go over to the next road and come back. At the other road, a mile from our house, was a man completely blind and his wife. We called her Aunt Belle, and she helped raise us children, 4 children, all in the same age group. She'd come through that pasture, cow trail, and help my mother wash the clothes and cook and whatever. We thought the world of her, and her husband stayed home blind as a, but he could get around real good. That's kind of how we were raised. My dad never said one curse word to me or never touched me with being angry, never.
Do you have any memories of what you wanted to do when you grew up? When you were a boy, did you have some of those ambitions or dreams that boys sometimes have? Hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this.
Well, yes. My neighbor was named Elvin Hubble, and Elvin had 3 or 4 boys we went to school with. He also had a brother named Carl Hubble. You have heard of him, I'm sure.
One of the greatest baseball pitchers of all time?
One of the biggest. He'd come to visit his hub. So I've seen Carl Hubble several times, and when he got out of the car one day, his left side was way overgrown, so all us boys wanted to be a ball pitcher.
Well, and Oklahoma's produced some pretty great ball players over the years.
That's exactly right.
Mickey Mantle comes to mind. But so here you're in a tiny little town in Oklahoma, but here's Carl Hubble, the star of the New York Giants, one of the a Hall of Fame pitcher.
Yes.
Coming to your town.
He never came to our place. He just come to Hubble's. But we'd always go play with the Hubble. They were only a half a mile away down a red brick field. You know, you couldn't drive a car up it when it rained. It was slick. When it rained, Dad had to go to get groceries on a mule. He had a mule he could ride, put a gunny sack on his saddle horn, ride the horse to Meeker 7 or 8 miles, get groceries because he couldn't get back if he took the car.
Uh-huh.
When it dried out, he could take the car.
Did being around Carl Hubble make you want to be a ball player?
Well, it was a thought, you know. His boys, the Hubble boys, his nephews all wanted to be baseball players. So naturally, that's all we thought about, you know. Later on, I kind of wanted to be a lawyer because I had a good memory. I had good grades in school, but my dad was a World War veteran.
I saw his picture on the wall.
Well, that's my cohorts in World War II.
You and your brother in your Navy uniforms.
My brother was 17. He couldn't be drafted. He had to beg my mother. I know he had to beg her. I didn't see it, but she had to go sign for him to get in the Navy. I had to go to Bourne and Shawnee. The doctors didn't give me a birth certificate, so they wanted to see my certificate. When we get, I didn't have one. Draft board said, well, bring your mother. So we went up down in town in a big brick building, Bramer building, upstairs, a draft board, and she said, yes, my son, he's 18 years old, January the 14th. Senior year in high school. The draft came, and all the grown men in the Madera High School teachers were drafted. There was only one man young enough left, and he was a drummer coach. Poor guy didn't know any more about algebra than I did. I just about failed algebra.
Because they had the drama teacher teaching math?
Well, they called some older ladies in that brought them back. And the best thing that happened to me, those old gals could be teachers.
Let me go back a little further.
because I want to hear how you ended up here in California. So, you know, here today in 2020, we hear a lot about COVID-19 and it's changing the economy and all these things are happening. But you lived through the Great Depression. What do you remember about that? How did it affect your family?
Well, Dad lost his bank account. Meeker Bank went under, and he lost his money, and it was only $100. But he was a good farmer. I didn't know till later, but he grew hogs 600 pounds. People don't believe this. So I went to a fair, and I saw 600-pound hogs exhibited in a fair, and then I went home, and my dad had as good as hogs. You know, he could grow cotton. He could pick up a handful of soil and tell what it would grow, really.
Just by looking at it or feeling it?
Feeling it. Uh-huh. That's how he did it. Well, let's go back to my dad and mother, when they married, came to California. He worked in Taft, California, in an oil factory and made money. He was from Arkansas. She was from Mississippi. They got a itch to go back to the old country. He brought a new T model Ford, and I'm confident that she was pregnant with me when they went back to Oklahoma. And going out of Bakersfield, the old T model wouldn't climb it.
Wouldn't get over the pass, huh?
But if you put it in reverse, it had a better gear, and it'd go back up that trail. You been up it?
I was up it the other day. So they climbed the pass in reverse?
And so she drove the T model, and he followed and scotched it when she got tired, keep her from running over him and killing the whole thing. Well, we got up on top, and then that T model made it in Oklahoma.
So they had experienced California.
Yes.
So when the Depression hits and things aren't the same
in
Oklahoma.
Well, everybody moved in that period.
So you told me about their journey going home. How about your family's journey out here from Oklahoma to California? What was that like?
Well, my dad's sister married a big farmer here, Sherman Thomas. He kept writing, come to California. 29 had passed. But Dad was a good farmer. We had hogs to eat. We had milk to drink. We had pecan trees. We had honeybees. We had cows to milk. Had corn to feed them. What else could you need? Honest to goodness, we never had a hungry day in our life. Never.
Well, how did you feel about leaving Oklahoma behind and coming here?
Well, I was only 7. Gerald was younger. Daughter was younger then. And the last baby was in my mother's arms. He was just been born. Bud, we called him Bud, but all of us men after the war became farmers. Bud didn't go because he's too young.
Too young. The quintessential picture of this is what we all saw in the Beverly Hillbillies when they load up everything in a car and it's falling off the sides. What did it look like for you guys? What did you drive out in?
We had an old boxcar. Car looked like a boxcar, big old trunk on the back. I don't know how it ever made California, so help me God. She would stop and get groceries on the way and in some city, make sandwiches and get some milk and make sandwiches while we were traveling. Okie style, boy. We got to Bakersfield just before Christmas. In fact, it was Christmas Eve. Got to Sherman Thomas place. But Bakersfield was fogged in. You know how the valley did. Mm-hmm. You couldn't see anything. Us kids jumped up. Are we going to run in the ocean, Mama? They talked about it from when they lived over on the coast. Mm-hmm. Is that the ocean, Mama? We're going to drive in the ocean? No, don't worry. That's not the ocean. So that evening, when it got to Bakersfield, we finally got to Madera. Dad had 5 cents in his pocket. That's the last money he had.
Wow. And this is 1933?
1933. They put us in a bunkhouse Sherman had there for his hands, and he had bought a mansion across from his house. We could see the mansion. An old man and his boy had built it. I don't know who built it, but he bought it. Boy went to school with us, this rich man. Sherman bought it. As soon as he could, he moved into it, and we moved into his house. Dad worked for Sherman for 2 years. Here at Chowchilla, they have an oil mill, cotton mills, cotton seed, and finance. They'll buy you a ranch if you gin with them and if you'll plant cotton. Cow pasture came near Howard School now, and man's cattle's on it. Dad bought it. The gin company gave him the money because he only had 5 cents. He leveled it with mules and a scraper, filled in the low spots, and took off the high spot. First year he planted cotton on that ground. It was buffaloes on it before and cows later. That turned to cotton. I never seen any place in the world. It was over my head at 7 years old.
You're in tall cotton, huh?
And I'm telling you, it turned to cotton. My dad had wells drilled, pumps put in, irrigating. He planned for us while we were in the Navy. He wanted us to be farmers. He didn't take any chances. He started buying land. He bought 100 acres next to him, and I got home in June of 1946.
Let me ask you about, you know, high school, because if I do the math right, you were 15, almost 16, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, my dad's birthday.
How did you hear about all that?
It's my dad's birthday. It was all over the world. We had radios, no fancy stuff, but no TV.
Do you remember that day and what it was like to hear that news?
Yes, I do.
What were you doing?
Everything, running around on the farm. I mean, I don't know why they attacked us, what they thought they were going to accomplish. But when we finally got into Japan, we went out through the country. They would take us out and let us walk around. And we went out to a little city-like place. And it's Christmas time. And I was looking at a house. They build their houses kind of low, not high like we do. And they had a pole along the top of the house and a big long pole. And I was wondering what I was playing with that pole and wondering what they were doing. A boy walked out of the house and he walked over to me, a Japanese boy, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking at that pole. I'm wondering what it's for. And he said, it's for knocking the snow off the roof in the wintertime. And he said, would you like to come in? And I'm thinking, hey, wait a minute, you know, is this a trap? Or is he? He says, I have friends in San Francisco. You have been in San Francisco? I said, yeah, several times. Well, come on in. We got to the door. He says, you have to take your shoes off. Made me take my shoes off. Went in, and they had a floor made out of things that grow in a swamp. And the family was eating a meal. He wanted me to eat. Well, I wasn't going to go for that. I balked there. I said, no, I'll not eat any arsenic. I didn't say that, but I thought that. And I said, why aren't you in the Army? He said, I'm just 17. He says, if it goes on any longer, I'm going to have to go. A month or two, I'll have to go. The family, they didn't seem to care what we said. We just sat down and talked a while. No, the people in Japan didn't. They didn't hate us. It was those warlords.
In order to learn that firsthand, he would have to make it through some hairy moments aboard the destroyer USS Bristol, and we'll hear about some of those when we come back. 94-year-old K.O. Leach of Madera, California, our guest today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable. Or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old K.O. Leach of Madera, California, a lifelong farmer. He would become a pilot. He trapped coyotes for the federal government. He's done a lot of things, but first he had to make it through World War II. He and his younger brother, Gerald, both served in the Navy during the war. Their father had been an Army man.
Did he ever tell you guys what he did in World War I?
No.
Didn't talk about it?
No, he wouldn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. His brother was with him. His brother died, pneumonia. And the conditions were so bad, Dad told me, don't get in the Army. He said, I slept in the mud. I slept in hog water, stretched up between trees to keep from sleeping in the mud and getting the bugs on me. He said, it's hell. It's hell. Don't get in the Army. Get in the Navy. Sacramento, California. What do you want to do? Army, Navy, Air Force? I said, Navy, and that's what I got.
And just to be clear on your uncle, who died in World War I, was that while he was he overseas when he
yes.
got pneumonia?
Yes. Okay.
So he was in Europe.
Yes.
He and your father both. He wasn't shot and killed, but he died from pneumonia because of exposure.
Yeah, that was the trouble, yeah, exposure. That's what most of them died from.
So your father was very emphatic, don't go in the Army, because of his experience.
Well, yeah. So I listened to that. I got out of boot camp, Farragut, Idaho, after 3 months. Big lake there to train sailors. My mother, I don't know how she got a ticket on a train. She got a ticket to Idaho to come see how I was.
Huh.
And she got a hotel room, and they told me to ask my commander I could go visit her. Yeah, you can go stay all night with your mother. And she had my little brother, Bud. He was 10 years old now. And that woman come up to Idaho.
I'm sure the other guys in boot camp had some fun with that. Did you get teased a little bit about mommy coming to see you?
Yeah, you're not a kid. Were you in the service?
No, but I can imagine.
Yeah. I started to say, you sound just like a boy.
Well, and
that's a good place to grow up. I'm not kidding you.
What did they do to you? How did they whip you into shape?
Marching every day, climbing over obstacles, running. When I come back to Frisco, a lieutenant walked up to me in Frisco on Treasure Island, tapped me on the shoulder, are you Kenneth Leach? Turned around and I saw Lieutenant, yes, sir. He said, what do you want to do in the Navy? I said, well, sir, I don't know. I'll do whatever there is to do. Be a boatswain, do whatever. Oh, no, you don't want to be no boatswain. He said, I've got your high school record. That principal gave me straight A's except a minus on algebra, minus A, but it still was an A. And he said, I saw you took typing. Yes, I did take it. He said, how much did you score? I said, I went the limit, 45 words a minute. Oh, that's what the Navy does. You want to be a radioman? I said, well, yeah, I'd like that. Okay, I'll send you to radio school. Hmm. That's what he did. They had a school right there,
uh-huh.
Treasure Island. First of all, they run the code.
Morse code?
Morse code. They run it by you day after day after day. Till you learn every single thing about it. How to send it, how to receive it. In the Navy, you couldn't make a mistake on the radio. It was usually fatal. But I learned that, and I never made a mistake. 2 years on that radio, never made a mistake. Because I positioned myself. We had 4 hours on the earphones, typewriter, 4 hours off, then go back again for another four. For 8 hours a day.
The four-hour shifts. Yeah.
You can't sit on your rear end any longer than that. It burns it up. See, we had a place where there's four, five, six big radio receivers.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to the Chicago Cubs. Roosevelt said, I'm not going to ban the series. We listened to it on the radio. We tuned in Honolulu.
I bet you had a few guys huddled around the radio for that, huh?
We had a whole bunch of them. Everybody that wasn't asleep was up there.
Tell me about when you got assigned to your ship. So you were only on one ship, right? The Bristol?
Yeah. Yes. DD-857.
DD-857. You've got some pictures of it on the wall. I even saw the route that you took around the Pacific on one of those.
7,000 miles from Frisco to Tokyo.
What was your first impression of the Bristol, and did you understand what the role of a destroyer really was?
Yes, we knew. See, they told us the battleship and the oil tanker and the aircraft carrier can't leave the port because they can't field subs. If they found a sub, had subs, it takes 40 acres for a battleship to turn around. Oil tanker, aircraft carrier the same way. So we had to go with them. Whenever they went, we went right alongside. I've been in some typhoons you wouldn't believe.
I want to hear about it. But as far as first getting aboard this ship, and this is the second Bristol of World War II because the first one was sunk.
Yeah.
So now they've got another one that's carrying that name.
Yes, that's right.
What was life like on that destroyer, and how'd you get along with all the other sailors aboard?
I made a friend with a semaphore boy. He did semaphore, I did code.
So he's communicating with the flags, and you're communicating through the code. All right.
He could just as much as I could, and I never understood that they didn't use them more. Mm. But one day, I just got off the radio, and I went up to see him. He was semaphore to shore. There's a little door that opens in the sea cabin of the captain. He was in it. We didn't know it. He was on his bunk resting. The semaphore guy says, "Where are we going?" And I had read the heading. I could read the heading of a message sent to our ship. I could read it. Who went to? Who'd send it? And what it probably meant. "Where are we going, Leach?" I'm standing here by this cabin. I said, "We're going to Tokyo." I went on back down in the radio shack. Captain come running down the stairs yelling, "This has got to quit. This has got to quit." "What's got to quit?" I was in my cabin and two seamen talking and told me where we're going to have to go. And when I read the message, that's what it said. Go to Tokyo. It's got to quit. It's got to stop.
He didn't want to head that way?
Or well, he'd lost one ship in Sicily when they went back to Sicily out of North Africa. He lost his ship there. They sunk it. And he was, of course, you know, if you had a ship, there's nothing that'll make you feel as bad. In Frisco, Treasure Island, where they bought the guys that survived sunken ships, you never saw such pitiful things. Their eyes, depression, they didn't know what was going on, they didn't know where they were, they didn't know what they'd been, they just didn't know any, they didn't have anything but the clothes on their back.
So even before you went overseas, you're there at Treasure Island, and you see these guys coming back.
That
can't be very encouraging.
No, well, it wasn't, but I knew where I was going. I knew where I was going.
And I didn't want to cut you off there when you were talking about the sailors who came back from ships that had been lost. Did you interact with those guys at all, or you just saw them walking by?
Well, most of them had to have psychotherapy. You know, they had to get back on track. I mean, boy, I want to tell you, we picked up, off the aircraft carriers, we picked up 10 pilots, those old putt-putt, one-engine, single-wing airplanes would go at 7 o'clock every morning, bomb Tokyo, but they couldn't get off the carrier. They'd get off, but they go in the water. And when a man goes in the water, the plane sinks. You can't see anything but his head. He's got a jacket on. I seen with my own eyes 10 of them die. 10 of them died.
That you guys were trying to save?
We tried to save them. We couldn't. We got one to the ship.
And these were guys who had been shot down or ran out of gas, or these were guys who had problems on...
No, they were taken off to go bomb Tokyo.
So they had trouble on takeoff.
Had bomb underneath the wheels. Too much weight. They'd go off that aircraft carrier, go down and touch the water, and if they got lucky, they'd go on up. They had plenty of them that went to bomb. They had plenty of them go. Mm-hmm. But I don't know many aircraft carriers was, but ours lost 10 men.
What were you thinking when you headed overseas? Did you have any concern that you might not make it back?
Well, we went into San Francisco Bay, We went down to San Diego, went on a cruise down Mexico way, down south, come back to San Diego. Our ship was put together in San Pedro. When I got on it, it had cables around it, demagnifying it, so it won't attract bombs. I got on it, had to walk over cables. Then it come time to go to get arms, so they sent us to San Francisco to get ammunition for the guns. And that night, off the Farallon Islands, we went through the biggest tornado, they called them, that I ever seen or heard of. I was holding on to that ship made out of iron. It'd go up like this, that wave would go out. It'd hit the bottom. I could feel that iron in my hand. It scared the living daylights out of me. I thought we was going to sink.
So this is just outside of San Francisco, the Farallons. You're coming back into the bay, but you almost don't make it. Because
we didn't make it. We left. We didn't try. You go back to sea. Get away.
Mm-hmm.
Get away from shore.
So that caught your attention, huh?
Next day, next morning, it was calm. We loaded ammunition all one day from a barge in the middle of San Francisco Bay. So if it exploded, it didn't kill anybody on shore. It took us all day long to load ammunition. The next morning, we left San Francisco Bay. And my thoughts were, there was a flag flying on the bridge across San Francisco Bay.
The Golden Gate Bridge, they had a flag hanging on it?
Yeah, with a pole in it, where the ship went under, flying, "Goodbye, old friend." And I was crying, "I hope to see you again. Goodbye." And I made it. I almost didn't, but I did.
Well, it sounds like in that moment you weren't so sure whether you would or not.
I wasn't sure at all, because they had the Philippines just swarmed all over it, had them kill 2,000 men on a march to get them out of the Philippines. MacArthur had to go to Australia, take his family. He couldn't stay in Manila. I saw him when he come back. He waded back in the water like he waded out. 18 years old, off the farm, never away from home. It kind of got to you. But our motto was, whatever it takes, whatever it takes, we're ready to go. And I'd go again today if I wasn't 94 years old.
If he says it, we better believe it. It's break time, but there's much more to come with 94-year-old Navy veteran K.O. Leach. Perhaps the closest call he experienced in World War II had nothing to do with the enemy, but his mother's prayers are a part of that story. And you're not going to believe the makeshift weapons he witnessed his shipmates using after the Japanese surrendered. You may have eaten one of those weapons today. We're also going to hear briefly from his grandson, who is carrying on that Navy legacy now. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old K.O. Leach of Madera, California. If you'd like to see what he looked like as a teenager in World War II, or how big a smile he and his wife Bernice are wearing after 73 years of marriage, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook.
Well, and you said, you know, when you were saluting that flag on the Golden Gate Bridge, heading out under it, saying goodbye, old friend, and you said you weren't sure you were going to make it back, and you almost didn't. So that tells me there's some stories we need to hear there about why you almost didn't. What did you go through that you look back on and say, yeah, that could have been it for me?
Around that armada, we were to hit 14 ships. They named them and pick up the mail. You got mail bags, and every ship going south to Honolulu would take the mail. We took 14 ships and collected that many bags of mail, then went back to the oil tanker. It was tied to the shore. We put the mail bags on the deck of the oil tanker. The sea was rough that day. We'd go down, the tanker'd go up, the tanker'd go down, we'd go up, and they got together, rubbing sides, and our anchor fluke on the anchor went through their deck.
Uh-oh.
Through the deck and over the outside and put a hole in their deck. They tried their lifts, their oil barrels and stuff to pull it out. They couldn't. They tried and tried and tried. We were hooked together for an hour or so, maybe longer. And the captain said, in the bottom on the thing that raises the anchor, there's a soft link at the bottom of this ship. If I put it full speed astern, I'll break that soft link and leave them the anchor, because we got to get away from them. Because the other fluke on the anchor was in our ship, cutting a hole big as a door, go up, cross, down, cross, and back up. And the good Lord was looking. The link didn't break. He put her full stern astern. The link didn't break. That oil tanker flipped. It didn't even move. It flipped that destroyer. I could see the bottom of it, half of it, where it was welded together. I was on the wrong side of the ship, one way, and one way it may have saved my life. I don't know why I was on the side where the hole was, but that's where I ended up. I was hanging to a cable, steel cable, looking down at the bottom of that ship. And they told us in boot camp, get away from a ship that's going to sink. If it goes more than 45, it's going to sink. It did not. It laid there, staff had the antennas on it, the main staff, flag on it, fell in the water, stretched out 50 feet, antennas all over it like your house. Bed springs, I call them.
So the mast is actually hitting the water?
The bed springs were hitting the water. I was trying to figure out what to do. I couldn't drop because the other deck was below me. If I dropped straight down, I'd kill myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was way up there, as wide as the ship was, half of it. I was hanging on for dear life, maybe praying. I don't know. I can't remember. Those antennas started going like this, like a bunch of fish feeding, and I said, this thing's going to come up. It's moving. So help me, Lord. That thing came up on its bottom. It came up on its bottom on its own accord. No help whatsoever. Now, how did it do it? It was 15 degrees too far gone already when it went past 45. I don't know.
I haven't heard one quite like that.
Well, I always felt that my mother took us to Sunday school, Christian woman, prayed day and night for those two boys. I took it to be for her. After the war, when we could write a letter, they wouldn't blot out some of it, tell where we was.
Mm-hmm.
Kenneth, find out what time in Tokyo it was whenever that ship come back up. I said, well, Mother, I'll find out. And I asked some of the guys that knew about time. They said it was 9:30 in the morning in Tokyo. And she says, well, at 2:30, ranch out here 7 miles west of Madera, she was praying. Said, God spoke to her, pray, Kenneth's in danger. Kenneth's in danger.
So she got up at 2:30 in the morning to pray for you.
She prayed from then all day long, not just 5 minutes.
And this is the very time that your ship is on its side, the antenna is touching the water, and you're on the high side of the ship holding on for dear life.
Yeah, well, if I had went where the hole was, I would have drowned.
Uh-huh.
Because the water would have rushed in and took me with it.
Right.
But it fell on the other side, on the right side of the ship, and I was on the left side.
Well, how about, what was that like when it came back up? What did that do to you where you were?
I just, I rode it back to, was no reason, it was full of water. The ship was half full of water, because I could see the halfway mark. So we were half in water, or they got the water drained out of the thing, and we steamed away. Go to Guam, a big dry dock there. At Guam.
Well, and that, if I read correctly, the day you had such a scare, the day that woke your mother up in the middle of the night back here in Madeira, that was August 5th, 1945.
Yeah.
The Enola Gay dropped the first atomic bomb the next day, August 6th.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear about that where you were on Guam?
Yeah.
What did they say? Did they say it was an atomic bomb? Did they say it was a whole city wiped out? How did they explain what had happened?
We couldn't imagine an atomic bomb. You know, because you're just off the farm and you're not really educated in bombs and stuff. And you couldn't believe that a whole city. Now, I'm telling you, one building in Hiroshima didn't burn up. I went and walked out to it. There was a river in Hiroshima, and it was filled with debris and quit running. There was a bridge down there on the beach, about as high as a house, and they didn't burn. I walked across the bridge.
When did you get to go there?
2 months after the bomb, because they're afraid of radiation. You can go see the site, but we're going to tell you you can't sue the government, because if you get radiation, you get married, you won't have any children.
They told you that at the time.
They told you that when we went, but all of us went. But I got 3 children, so I didn't get radiation.
And 8 grandkids, and you got great-grandkids and great-great-grandkids. So what was that like to look at this city that had been leveled by a weapon no one had ever heard of before?
Well, my reaction is that life on Earth is not too long left in this. I don't know how many more years. I'm reading the Bible, and I don't know how long it's going to but it's going to be changed. It can't possibly go on like it is.
So seeing that made you feel as though the end of the world were near.
Yes, yeah. And every country started getting a weapon.
And because now we can look back and say no one has deployed, they've tested them, but no one's deployed an atomic weapon since Nagasaki. But at the time, you're thinking, well, if they're going to do this, we're not going to last very long.
Yeah, that's what we thought.
So that was after the Japanese surrendered that you went there. But I want to talk about what that was like to hear that news, because you're there getting your ship repaired in Guam. But I think once they got you fixed up, you guys went back to Tokyo Bay, right?
Yes. Tokyo Bay was small. There wasn't too much room. There was English ships. There was Australian ships, American ships, and other ships. And it was full of ships. It wasn't much room for aircraft carriers. They had to get out in open sea, and you had to go with them. We tried to go out of port and dark because of the submarines. Submarine couldn't see us after dark. Periscope couldn't see us. But we could have sonar. Battleships don't have sonar. Mm-hmm. Neither do carriers or tankers. So you have to go with them, or they'll get sunk. One day, we had coming up the China Sea. We'd been south to help a battleship. We was coming back up the sea next to Japan. A sub surfaced right ahead of the sub ahead. There was a destroyer just like ours, just ahead of us. He saw that sub. He took after it. We didn't have any weapons. They lock them up. Didn't do any good to have them anyway. So he just decided that he would T-bone that sub. He's going to ram it. Mm-hmm. There he went. He ran right up on the front end, head of the back part. The Japanese came running out of the sub. It was partially underwater already. I don't know how big I saw it. we didn't have any ambulance. The boys come out of the mess hall throwing arse potatoes at those Japanese riflemen. Now, I'm telling you the truth.
So the Japanese are firing?
Firing rifles.
Right. The small arms on your ship are locked up.
They're locked up.
So since you guys have no access to that.
You couldn't get them.
And they're not going to be firing the big guns. So they're throwing a potato like a football trying to hit the Japanese with it.
So we were copying all this.
Yeah.
On our radio while he was trying to sink them. The radio man, this is hogwash. This is somebody just, you know, blowing smoke. The only thing it made us realize, the next day, our captain issued 300 sambui daggers. Everybody on that ship got a knife. So there was something to it. He wouldn't have given us knives to fight with if he hadn't verified it.
So I understand you correctly, you're on the radio.
I'm on the radio.
And you're describing what is happening.
Yeah.
Kind of like what I do at a football game or a basketball game. You're given the play-by-play.
Yeah.
And in this case, the play-by-play is a bunch of sailors are hurling potatoes at Japanese submariners.
Yes, I saw.
You're hearing back, quit lying to us, or you're making this up, or something like that?
Somebody kept hollering, you hogwash. But I did see them throwing potatoes.
You said something earlier that I need to follow up with. You said you went through three typhoons?
Well, the one in Frisco.
You told me about that, about the Farallones.
Me very bad. Then I went one off of Japan. We went out to help a battleship that was in trouble from some reason and started back to the bay. A typhoon hit us, and we couldn't go in the bay. We're afraid to try it. And the battleship surely couldn't. And off the shore of this little island, we had another one like Frisco. It hit us. I was afraid to go to bed. I was afraid we'd sink. I could hold myself down, but it just shake that ship. You don't shake a 30-ton ship.
You know, there's one more question I want to ask you, and if there's anything I didn't ask you about that you think I ought to know.
I don't want to ask.
What are you most proud of?
Our marriage. We farmed together for 72 years. I don't want to claim to be a hero. I saw heroes die. Lots of them.
Indeed. Some of the more than 406,000 Americans who gave their lives in World War II the way your uncle had in World War I. You said there that your marriage is what you're most proud of. So I want to know, what's your secret? If there's somebody listening who would like to be married for 73 years, and hey, I'm one sitting right here. So what would you tell us?
I loved her when I saw her, and I'll love her forever.
And she obviously loves you, and she's right here. So let's get Bernice Leach's take on that, too.
We have the same values in life, and that's very important to have the same values in life. And I tell my young people when I see them, I say, start praying. Pray for the one. Don't just go out and pick them out yourself. Just pray for one. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's what happened. That's how it happened. We have the same values in life. And there's a funny thing I tell some of the girls. I say, well, when we had our arguments, he'd say, well, you want to pack your clothes and go home to your mother? And I said, no, I'll pack my clothes and go home to your mother. And you know what your mother will do to you. And we start laughing. And we learned to work together, too.
They are still working together, and they serve as inspiration to their descendants, including one grandson following in Mr. Leach's Navy footsteps. Lieutenant Commander Joshua Earls has spent 12 years as a Navy chaplain.
All the guys in the family used to go deer hunting every year. We wouldn't really catch anything. It would be mainly just to kind of get away from the ladies and just do, you know, all that stuff together. And I was 12 years old or so, and my grandpa's really big on telling stories, and he would tell hunting stories all the time. And he was doing that again, and we're all sitting around the campfire, and I asked him, you know, hey, Grandpa, you tell all these hunting stories. Do you have any Navy stories? Because he never really talked about it that much. He looked at me and he said, you know, that was such a long time ago, and I don't remember too much. And he said, I might have one or two stories. And like 6 hours later, he was still telling stories, you know, and some of them are like hilarious and some of them are like, what is what? you know, just like it's like a like an everyday occurrence, you know, when, oh, we had to go get pilots out of the water and just all of these things. If his experiences, as if they were just kind of like, yeah, you know, I got one or two stories. And I just remember thinking as a young boy, like, my goodness, that's an experience and a kind of importance on not to diminish anybody's, you know, doing anything, but just that's on a grander scale than like some deer hunting stories. You know, I mean, he's talking about World War II and huge naval battles and things like that. And that just always kind of seared in my memory. I remember that kind of flooding back to me because I was a freshman in college when 9/11 happened. And when you're kind of in that transitional period of life and that hits with something like 9/11 or something like Pearl Harbor happening, you know, it kind of really kind of changes the course of your life quite a bit. I had already kind of felt called into ministry, but, you know, to kind of match that with, hey, something very serious has happened. And there's kind of not just a call to arms, but a call to like, hey, there's a need to kind of protect our way of life in the face of such kind of extreme evil. And not the specific stories, but the kind of nature of, you know, my grandfather and doing that same kind of thing during World War II kind of came flooding back pretty fast. What really hit me was the seriousness of what they were doing. I mean, he was intertwining it with, you know, just stories that are like funny. And anytime you put a bunch of guys on a small ship and, you know, have them together for months on end, some funny stuff's going to happen. So he was intermixing it with that. But the gravity of the stuff that they went through, and it's just like, my goodness, like, I, you know, I'm upset or moved by these small little trivial things. And even now, after 12 years of being in the military, we don't really have those experiences on the same kind of grand scale that they had in World War II. So when I go through stuff now, and my stuff's a little different because I, you know, as a chaplain, I'm kind of caring for people. So mine's kind of the secondary experience of those things, kind of like the, almost like the caregiver guilt or the caregiver kind of weight that comes along with it. I kind of often reflect on the stuff that my grandfather went through during his time in the Navy, you know, with the kind of selfless leadership and sacrifice that he always showed. And I never saw him in the military or in the Navy, but I saw him as just a salt of the earth guy who loved his family, loved his God, and lived for those things, and did it in such a way where his little 8-year-old grandson is not knowing he's watching, but is watching, you know, and to say that I'm so lucky to carry those things with me naturally. And I'm not saying I'm doing them perfectly, but I can carry them as just a normal experience of this is how you are to be, because I was able to kind of watch those things. And that stuff is done in my family and done in my job as a chaplain, and hopefully carried on to, in my world, engaging with sailors and Marines when I'm with them, with people who are usually going through some very, very, very difficult situations. And hopefully I'm imparting to them not just my own stuff, but I'm imparting to them that heritage as well. You know, my grandfather was a huge part of that, and I can never thank him enough for it.
That family legacy carries on, but unfortunately, our time on the radio is coming to a close. If you pull up the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, you can hear a little more from grandfather and grandson. Thanks to Lieutenant Commander Earls for his ongoing service to our country, and also a special thanks to his cousin, Allison Leach, an Emmy Award-winning costume designer who knew how special their grandparents are and gave me the privilege of sharing an hour's worth of audio evidence in that regard with you. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
And if I do the math, if you've been married 73 years, that's 1947. That's only a year after you got out of the Navy. So Tell me the story of how you met your wife.
They sent me home from San Francisco, Treasure Island, and it was 6 days over 2 years that I'd have been in the Navy.
Uh-huh.
So all the girls that I was in high school with were married, 18 and 19, all had family,
mm-hmm.
married. Everyone that you look for, they'd already married.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of guys that weren't wives about that time.
Yeah.
Sailors, army officers. And something struck me, zip, like that. Go down to the old church where you went to Sunday school and see what they've got to offer.
So you were scouting things out, huh?
And so help me. I went down to the church and looked the girls all over. Something happened. The girls jumped up for some reason. And I saw her, 17 years older and 4 months. Zip over here. There you go. That was it. I didn't know who she was. I'd never seen her. She'd never seen me. I got home, and when I got out of the Navy, I started farming.
Mm-hmm.
My dad prepared for me. He bought land while he could because he made a fortune, cotton and arse potatoes for the Army. And Dad made money, and lots of it. And he'd buy land. And he said, well, I'll buy land, get these boys farming when they get home. And I kind of had a chance to go to college, straight A's. Kenneth, what do you want to do? I said, Dad, I don't know, but I kind of want to go back. And they're going to give me another thing on my shoulder, up me a great pay raise, and send me to school. No, can I? You don't want to do that. You need to get to farming. He said he was digging potatoes. When I left in June, 2 years, he was digging potatoes. When I got back 2 years and 6 days later, he was digging potatoes. You hear of arse potatoes from Idaho? Him and his partner said, Dad said, if you go to farming, as soon as we get these potatoes out of here, you can. He had 40 acres of cotton planted, ready to. Starting to bloom, I'll give you this 100 acres. How can I stop that? Dad, I knew Dad wanted me to be a farmer. A lawyer, I wanted to be, but I would have broke his heart. So I said, Dad, where's the tractor? I think that cotton needs to be worked.
Let me ask you, you said that you had that dream of being a lawyer, but it would have broken your dad's heart if you did that. Have you ever thought over the years whether you made the right decision, or have you ever wondered about that?
No, I never had. I met her, and I farmed for 70 years, 70 married years, and I never regretted a minute. My dad was one of the best, like I've told you before, one of the best men I ever was connected with. He never hit us boys. He never cursed us. He just showed us how to work and taught us how to do it. We were all three of us were successful. We were a successful farmer. We all made livings, every one of us, but we all had to work together.
Well, why don't you give me your version of when you met him?
Well, that was true, and the reason we had never met before, and he knew about my sister marrying one of his best friends, but we had never met, and I'm 5 years younger than he is.
Yeah.
So we didn't even go to school together. But while he was away, my family started to the same church he was going to. So I knew his family, but I didn't know him. And so when we met, it was like I said, he was home for a while before we actually met. But I felt the same way because he told me later that when he saw me, he knew I was the one. And when I saw him walk in the door, I knew he was the one. Because I had boyfriends, but they never did, you know, affect me like he did. Because when I saw him, I knew too, because I'd been praying. Now, my life was a life of prayer, and I'd said, okay, God, these aren't the ones. Send me the one. And so we have the same values in life, and that's very important to have the same values in life. We learned to work together too, so. So I knew how to drive a tractor and milk cows because I was raised on a farm.
Mm-hmm.
So we just had a lot of things in common. And even though we knew each other a short time, I knew his parents longer than I knew, you know, just have the same values in life.
Beautiful.
We worked together, yeah. And he was a good father. He was so good to his kids. And he still is to this day. He's good to his kids and his grandkids and all of them. He just, you know, he never was mean. And, of course, he never did cuss them. And We heard one time a minister on television talking about drugs, you know, kids getting involved in drugs. And he says, you know what? Says, I was drugged when I was young. He says, my dad got me out of the bed every Sunday morning and drugged me to church. That was David Jeremiah said that.
That's good.
So, yeah. So that's and that's why with on a farm, I would recommend everybody live on a farm with all the animals and stuff and things to do. We had horses, we had animals, and they had to help feed the baby calves. So there was always something to do, you know, and plenty of good neighbors to, they'd go all ride their horses together and just that kind of stuff. And I think that the kids nowadays don't have things like that. Oh, they can mow lawns for jobs and they can do different stuff, but they need to be involved in something.
Is there something about him that you would say you admire or respect the most or just really appreciate about him and who he is?
I don't know about the most, but there's plenty that I admire and respect about him. One of the things, and this has helped so much in the Navy, because active duty service in the military is far different than being, you know, what we call, you know, a civilian, just not being in the military. And it is like stepping on Mars. It is just a completely different world. And one of the things I enjoy the most about my grandfather, and I never saw this in terms of his service, but I saw it in terms of his, you know, work and his dedication to the family and, the, you know, his experience as farming the land and things like that, of just this kind of like, hey, this determination of there's work to be done or this thing needs to be addressed. It's going to be really difficult. It might not even be all that fun. It might even be really, really painful. That's okay. We'll get through it. God will be gracious to us. So let's just get on with doing it. You know, and that's so beneficial to kind of remember that kind of character and that kind of perspective. Because when you're faced with things like, hey, I'm going to be gone, you know, for the next, you know, 8 months, 10 months, or, you know, leading up to those times over what we call the workup cycle, like leading up to a deployment and then the deployment itself, like we're not going to be too much of a family for the next 2 years. Not just saying, hey, it's no big deal, you'll just get through it, but not letting it overwhelm you too much. It's what's in front of you. We're going to be determined about it. We're going to be really devoted to each other through it, but we're going to go and it's going to be okay. Yeah. So that kind of just simple workmanlike determination that doesn't allow too much to get you down or overwhelmed, but is dedicated not only just to what's in front of you, but to, you know, what you hold most dear, even in the moments of the difficulty. That I just remember watching that a lot when I was younger and probably not being able to articulate it like that, but even as a teenager and carrying that on.
Is there anything you think people should know about the men and women in our armed forces now and how the rest of us as civilians can support them, you know, in your role as a chaplain, maybe how people can pray for them? What are some things that those of us who aren't serving can do to back up those who are?
Well, I'll say, I mean, not that I've been in a long time, been 12 years, but even being in at the tail end of a two-front war with Iraq and Afghanistan, and going to Afghanistan myself, you really, like, even it's been this way for a while, but even back then, of course, like, you know, a very politically charged viewpoints about what we should or should not be doing with any of that, that I think for the most part, at least in my experience, the American public at large has been very supportive and very respectful of the military. That kind of realization, and this is just my own observation. I don't know I haven't done any research or anything on this, but it's almost as if I think the American populace kind of felt the wrongness maybe of some of the stuff coming out of like the Vietnam War and how, you know, it's like, hey, the public responded, even to some of the public responded to, you know, those men and women who were like, hey, man, I got drafted, like I had to go. And some of the response to that, and as a, you know, just saying, no matter what, even if we don't agree maybe with how they're being used or what war is going on, we're still going to treat the men and women of the armed forces with utter respect and kind of dignify what they're doing. So, I mean, I would applaud the public for always kind of making, or at least in my experience, always making everybody feel appreciated and important. In terms of care, things they can do, honestly, I would just say that it's that, and I want to be careful I say this because I don't want to say that we're them at all. But, you know, you like this kind of thing, hopefully, you know, what I imagine what you're doing, you're saying like, hey, we have someone, right, in our midst who is a part of the greatest generation, and it's incumbent upon us to remember and reflect and know them and what they've done, because it's not just, hey, they should be honored. Yes, of course they should. But also that we're molded and we learn stuff from remembering what they went through, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say, I don't think that has to be, that has to wait until current men and women who have experienced things are, you know, 70, 80, 90 years old. That kind of stuff can happen right now. And sometimes that requires a little more. It's not as easy as just sending something, which is very appreciated and respected. But I would say that to actively kind of seek those service members out or ex-service members out and just allowing them to kind of influence you through their own experiences, their own stories, because there's a level, and not to say it's better, but there's just a different level of service when you're talking about active duty military that people in the civilian world just aren't used to and don't go through. And I think just as people on active duty can and should learn from civilians, because sometimes we get a little out of whack because we think what we go through is completely normal, which it's not. Much in the same way, you know, befriending and knowing active duty service members can, you know, influence civilians quite a lot as well.